dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.
This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. A remarkable conference took place mid-September in Andover, Massachusetts, that hasn't gotten the coverage it deserved. It was called the Justice Robert Jackson Conference on the Planning for the Prosecution of High-Level American War Criminals, and it was convened by Lawrence Velvel, Dean of the Massachusetts School of Law. Among its attendees were legal scholars and practitioners of international and human rights law who gathered and pledged to devise a strategy to, in the words of the dean, hold high U.S. officials accountable in courts of law and, if guilt is found, obtain appropriate punishments. I'm going to begin airing presentations from that conference next week. I wanted to provide some context for the discussion by reviewing some of the evidence and witnesses that could be presented at some future trial of high-level U.S. officials and former officials. We'll do this via a radio adaptation of a powerful new documentary, Torturing Democracy, produced by Sherry Jones of the National Security Archive. Some people have been able to view this film on their local PBS stations, but most have not. PBS told the filmmakers that no national air date was available until January 20th, 2009, Barack Obama's inauguration day. The filmmakers have made it available online at torturingdemocracy.org, and if you can stream video, I strongly urge you to view it. But I know many listeners can't. So I will bring you the audio this week. Following the film, we'll continue with our serial reading from Dr. Susan Rosenthal's 2006 book, Power and Powerlessness. This is Torturing Democracy, written and directed by Sherry Jones and narrated by Peter Coyote.
I want to be absolutely clear with our people and the world. The United States does not torture.
We do not condone torture.
It's against our laws. It's against our values.
I have never ordered torture.
I have not authorized it, and I will not.
Funding for Torturing Democracy has been provided by the Ford Foundation, the Schumann Center for Media and Democracy, the Park Foundation, the Jet Foundation, the HKH Foundation, and the ARCA Foundation.
The 5th, 8th, and 14th Amendment of the Constitution of the United States prohibit cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment.
The attacks were unprecedented in their daring and their destructiveness. When the president heard the first reports in a Florida elementary school, the vice president had already been rushed to the bunker beneath the White House. There, he watched the second tower fall.
Tonight, we are a country awakened to danger and called to defend freedom. Our grief has turned to anger, and anger to resolution. Whether we bring our enemies to justice or bring justice to our enemies, justice will be done.
In the White House, the fear of a second attack was palpable. The tone, aggressive.
Dick Cheney TV appearance, September 16th, 2001.
We also have to work, though, sort of the dark side, if you will. We've got to spend time in the shadows and in the intelligence world. A lot of what needs to be done here will have to be done quietly, without any discussion, using sources and methods that are available to our intelligence agencies, if we're going to be successful. That's the world these folks operate in.
Richard Schifrin, Department of Defense General Counsel for Intelligence, 1998 to 2003.
When 9/11 happens, new, radical, revolutionary, even strange ideas are brought to the fore. 9/11 created or contributed to what became a perfect storm.
At the eye of the storm was Vice President Dick Cheney.
When photos went up in the executive branch offices, in the past it had been, like in the Department of Defense, it would be the president, the secretary of defense. In this administration, it was the president and the vice president, and then the secretary of defense.
Richard Schifrin was a top civilian lawyer in the Pentagon at the time.
The vice president is not in the chain of command, in the military chain of command. The secretary of defense reports directly to the president. But the vice president clearly took on a role that was at least untraditional in recent history.
In that role, the vice president and his longtime legal advisor, David Addington, would press their shared belief in unfettered presidential power. Addington convened a group of like-minded political appointees. White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez, who had been the president's legal arm since their days together in Texas. Gonzalez White House deputy Tim Flanagan. William Jim Haynes, Addington's protege, who was now the Pentagon's general counsel. And John Yoo, whom a colleague called a godsend. Yu's post in the Justice Department meant that within the executive branch, legal opinions he penned had the weight of law. The five lawyers met behind closed doors in the White House or the Pentagon and called themselves the War Council. 2 weeks to the day after the terrorist attacks, they launched their legal revolution. A radical opinion asserted that Congress could not
place any limits on the president's determinations as to any terrorist threat, the amount of military force to be used in response, or the method, timing, and nature of the response. These decisions under our Constitution are for the president alone to make.
Impatience with the rule of law and the firm conviction that the commander-in-chief had the authority to ignore it would become a hallmark of the war on terror.
More than 2 weeks ago, I gave Taliban leaders a series of clear and specific demands. None of these demands were met. And now, the Taliban will pay a price.
The assault on the Taliban in Afghanistan was built around American air power and U.S. agents on the ground calling in the shots. But as Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda disappeared into the rugged mountains on the Afghan-Pakistan border, the Pentagon increasingly relied on bounty hunters. Tens of thousands of leaflets promising enough money to take care of your family and your village for the rest of your life were dropped by psychological ops teams.
Where is Arab? Where is Arab? Where is Arab?
Javed Ibrahim Paracha.
$1,000 for one Arab. 30,000, 40,000, 60,000. And helicopter, loudspeaker announcing these things.
Any Arab in the region was at risk of being turned in as a terrorist.
As soon as we handed over to the U.S. military, they tie their hands behind their back and put sacks over our heads.
24-year-old Shafiq Rasool was among hundreds of men who had been rounded up by a warlord in northern Afghanistan.
We couldn't see what was going on. We couldn't see anything around me. We didn't know where they were taking us. We didn't know what was happening. They kept shouting things like that. We were the ones responsible for 9/11. We'd killed members of their family, and they were going to take their revenge out on us. And they had rifles in their hands, and they could have shot us at any time.
We were hauled like animals, one drawing the other in its walk. They started making us run towards the unknown. The prisoners started shouting and crying because of their severe pain. There were many young people with us, and the soldiers increased their insults and beatings.
Over the noise and the din of the engines, screaming at the soldiers, profanities, swearing, the flashes that could be made out even despite wearing a black hood over my head, of trophy pictures being taken.
In Washington, the question of what to do with the captives grew urgent, and the vice president grew impatient. While he led a ceremony marking Veterans Day, behind the scenes, his legal counsel crafted a plan that would deny the prisoners access to America's civilian and military justice.
Veterans Weekend, I got a phone call from Jim Haynes. And it was, we have a small group working on a document. We would like for you to come up and review the document.
General Tom Romig was one of the top military JAGs pushed to the side from the beginning.
Some of the things they were initially talking about were very draconian. There were issues about how many members of the panel did it take to convict and then sentence to death.
General Romig convened an urgent meeting of senior military lawyers to war game how to respond to a far-reaching military order.
We had hoped we could make a difference in changing a number of things in there. We didn't.
They didn't, in part, because the vice president had convened a meeting of his own to finalize the plan. David Addington and other lawyers from the War Council were there. The military lawyers were not. Within 48 hours, Cheney took the four-page order to the weekly lunch he and President Bush privately shared. Less than 2 hours later, it was signed by the commander-in-chief. The president, it said, had the unilateral power to declare that all prisoners were war criminals. And further,
they shall not be privileged to seek any remedy in any court of the United States or any international tribunal.
They could be held indefinitely and would be tried, if at all, in a new process with new rules. Conviction could mean
life imprisonment or death.
Pentagon General Counsel Haynes said it would be the Nuremberg of our time.
Richard Schifrin.
They viewed this as accomplishing what Nuremberg accomplished for the losers in World War II, and that is the legal imprimatur on imposing the death penalty. There would be maybe dozens of people, bin Laden on down, who would be captured and who would qualify for the death penalty. We couldn't execute them without some sort of system.
Dick Cheney, November 14th, 2001.
We think it's the appropriate way to go. We think it's guarantees that we'll have the kind of treatment of these individuals that we believe they deserve.
that, of course, was premised on the idea that everyone we captured and detained really was a bad person. As it turns out, a large percentage of them were merely shepherds.
Historically, the military has carried out battlefield interrogations and operated according to strict, bright-line rules.
The U.S. Army Field Manual on Interrogation defines torture as the infliction of intense pain to body or mind to extract a confession or information or for sadistic pleasure.
In the days after 9/11, President Bush had ordered the Central Intelligence Agency to capture or kill al-Qaeda operatives around the world. In the chaos of Afghanistan, agents took their pick of the prisoners.
These terrorists.
Yes.
Yes. These men are terrorists.
I believe.
These men are terrorists. All these men are terrorists. I think you're terrorists. You come here to Afghanistan to kill people.
We're in the middle of a global war on terror, and commanders have information needs that need to be answered now. In fact, better yet, they should have been answered yesterday.
Colonel Steve Kleinman is a veteran Air Force interrogator who served in both Iraq wars.
At some point, when we realized interrogation was going to be very important after 9/11, the agency apparently looked within its capabilities, its personnel, and found that they didn't have a real formal, structured interrogation capability.
Hobbled by its lack of experience in dealing with this new enemy, the CIA scrambled. For interrogation advice, they turned to Arab countries the U.S. had long accused of torture. Private contractors were hired. And someone pulled the CIA's old Bible of Interrogation off the shelf. The manual, codenamed Kubark, was an artifact of the Cold War. During the Korean War, American prisoners were tortured by their communist captors.
Confiscated films show the Red Press.
36 of them, airmen shot out of the sky, were kept isolated and tortured psychologically.
By the communist propaganda machine throughout the world.
They confessed to elaborate conspiracies.
He told us that our two outboard wing bombs were germ bombs. We dropped at Guangzhou.
I forgot to mention on the germ bombs that we...
Very well-educated, committed people, committed to a cause, suddenly appearing in a trial and making these wild allegations about their role in some insurgent group within the Soviet Union, their role as recruited assets of the CIA when we knew that they weren't. So it scared a lot of people. What method were they using to get people to do these things?
The shocking truth.
It was a propaganda coup for the North Koreans. Until the war ended and the POWs were released.
All this information given in this so-called confession was entirely without basis. It was wrung out of me by torture, both mental and physical.
One pilot, trying to explain what happened to him, described a slow, quiet, and diabolical poisoning of the mind. But poisoning his mind left no physical scars.
Out of the bitter prisoner of war lessons learned in Korea comes the School for Survival at Stead Air Force Base in Nevada.
The U.S. military created a secret program to inoculate troops at highest risk of capture. They were trained in survival, evasion, resistance, and escape, called SEER, using harsh methods copied from the communists.
Here, the prisoner is subjected sometimes for hours to machine gun questioning.
The CIA also studied the communist techniques that had produced the false confessions and concluded that prolonged isolation and deprivation reduced prisoners to animals.
Rigorous training for young Americans who must face an implacable foe and not break on the rack of physical and mental torture.
Those secret studies led to Kubark, which the CIA itself later set aside amidst congressional investigations into the legality of the interrogation methods. But in 2001, at an American prison camp in Afghanistan, Kubark would be revived.
In Kandahar, it seemed to be an initiation ceremony almost, and a precursor to something a lot more intensive.
Mozam Beg, a British citizen, had been seized by Pakistani officers who burst into the Islamabad apartment where he and his family were living.
It's almost like a conveyor belt. We can hear the sounds of other prisoners screaming, being screamed at, dogs barking.
Kubark's menu of coercive interrogation techniques instructed that prisoners be cut off from the known and plunged into the strange.
If you can't see anything, you're going to be terrified. It's the dark that humans are afraid of, not the light. Somebody puts a black bag over your head, then you hear the sound of a gun. You think, oh, my head is going to be blown off. And that did happen. I heard that sort of chick-chick sound several times. So if the Americans are doing it, and they're not accountable, then who's going to come to your rescue?
In Washington, top officials were contemplating interrogations of unprecedented harshness.
Common Article 3 of the Geneva Convention specifically bans all violence to life and person, including cruel treatment and torture, and outrages upon personal dignity, in particular humiliating and degrading treatment.
A violation of Geneva's Article 3 ban on torture is a war crime under U.S. law.
The prohibition in the Geneva Conventions against cruel treatment turns out to have been probably the most important of the legal restrictions that the Bush administration had to deal with.
Martin Lederman was a senior advisor in the Justice Department at the beginning of the Bush administration.
In this administration, President Bush has, by all accounts, been quite forthright in that he's asked his lawyers not to give him the best view of the law, but instead to push the envelope. The metaphor that they've used is to go as close to the line, the legal line, as possible without going over. So the metaphor they've come up with is to get chalk on one's spikes. This was the message that went out from the White House.
On January 9th, 2002, in the first of a series of opinions that would provide legal cover for coercive interrogations, John Yoo began to push the envelope.
Customary international law of armed conflict in no way binds the president or the U.S. armed forces concerning the detention or trial of members of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban.
In other words, the president has the power to suspend or simply ignore the fundamental laws of war. That includes Geneva and its guarantees of basic human rights to prisoners and civilians alike.
Our views were well known in this matter. We were not on board.
Richard Armitage served three combat tours in Vietnam.
For the most part, the Department of State was left out of this discussion, I think precisely because we would have no part of it.
The State Department's top lawyer called John Yoo's legal reasoning seriously flawed and warned that if heading to the dark side meant violating Geneva,
this raises a risk of future criminal prosecution for U.S. civilian and military leadership and their advisors by other parties to the Geneva Conventions.
That is, if officials, including President Bush, were accused of torture or inhumane treatment, they could be prosecuted for war crimes. While the clash escalated in Washington, in Afghanistan, most every Arab captured by or sold to the United States was being readied for a trip halfway around the world.
The soldiers come, just grab you, pick you up, and basically drag you to the plane.
Shafiq Rasool, detainee 086.
And they put gloves on our hands, tape the gloves to our hands so we can't take them off, and they put handcuffs on. We went around our waist, down to our feet, shackled our feet together.
The words of Mohammed Massouz, detainee 294.
They had destroyed all our senses. Neither to see, neither to hear, neither to speak, neither to feel, nor to move our fingers.
The words of Ahmed Arachidi, detainee 590.
A guard hissed, "From now on, we dictate your food, your water, your sleep, and your You have no life." That whisper lived with me for 5 years. It became louder and louder in my ears.
The photographs of shackled and blindfolded prisoners provoked alarm, and an urgent letter from Amnesty International reminding Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld that the term cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment should be interpreted to extend the widest possible protection against abuses, including the holding of a detained or imprisoned person in conditions which deprive him of the use of any of his natural senses.
How do you respond to charges? Hooding, shaving, chaining, perhaps
what are the words?
Hooding. Putting hoods on this, shaving, chaining, perhaps even tranquilizing some of these people who are violating their civil rights.
Donald Rumsfeld, press conference, January 11th, 2002.
That's not correct.
That you've done it, or that it's
a violation of their rights. It simply isn't. And
whether or not they agreed, the administration had its first public warning. The war on terror was pushing the edge of international law. The prison camp at Guantanamo, the legal equivalent of outer space, one official called it, would push even closer to that edge.
Words of Asif Iqbal, detainee 087.
When I had the goggles and the shackles removed, I thought I was hallucinating. I could just see a series of cages with people wearing orange.
In many Arab countries, orange is the color worn by prisoners condemned to die. They were, Secretary Rumsfeld said, the most dangerous, best-trained, vicious killers on the face of the earth. Interrogators assumed they were in custody because they should be.
Shafiq Rasool.
They say, if you don't admit to being a member of Al-Qaeda, if you don't admit to meeting Osama bin Laden, that if you don't care what happens to yourself, we can do whatever we want to your family. We can deport them back to their home countries, Pakistan, and the Pakistani government can do whatever they want.
They were held in isolation and secrecy, locked into a system of punishment before any evidence of guilt was established.
Then you start losing hope. You think you're going to be spending the rest of your life here.
In Washington, Secretary of State Colin Powell, the most experienced military man among the president's top advisors, stepped up his defense of Geneva's half-century of war-fighting rules.
Richard Armitage, Deputy Secretary of State, 2001 through 5.
We were trying to wrestle with how to fight both an enemy and an idea, and I think it came up with a wrong-headed solution, opting out of Geneva. We, after all, want our soldiers, should they be unfortunate enough to be captured, to be treated in a proper way. And yet we weren't willing to afford that to others. That seems a little counterintuitive to me. It did at the time, and it does now.
Before the Secretary of State could make his case to the president personally, he was undermined by the vice president. In a blunt memo written by Cheney's counsel, David Addington, but delivered by White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez, Bush was advised that the war on terror
renders obsolete Geneva's strict limitations on questioning of enemy prisoners.
And in an argument that could have been written by a criminal defense lawyer, the president was told that opting out of the Geneva Conventions
substantially reduces the threat of domestic criminal prosecution under the War Crimes Act.
If you were twisting yourselves into knots because you're fearful that you may be avoiding some war crimes, then you're probably tripping too closely to the edge.
Addington clearly, I think, was the brain power behind this. And I think they felt like their flexibility within what they had designed was such that there wouldn't be any fear of repercussions, legal repercussions.
Colonel Larry Wilkerson, a 31-year military veteran, had long been an aide to General Colin Powell.
They had a vision. They were ruthless in carrying it out, and they executed it very well.
We're discussing all the legal ramifications of how we how we characterize the actions at Guantanamo Bay. A couple of things we agree on. One, they will not be treated as prisoners of war. They're illegal combatants. Secondly, they will be treated humanely. And then I'll figure out, I'll listen to all the legalisms and announce my decision when I make it.
There were a number of things that people were ready to jettison because these were different times.
Major General Thomas Romig, Judge Advocate General, U.S. Army, 2001 through 5.
That's a dangerous thing because then you can always have the excuse to jettison the law, the procedures, the due process, the conventions, whatever you want, when it's convenient.
On February 7th, 2002, for the first time in history, President Bush declared that the United States would not be constrained by Geneva's prohibitions against cruel and inhumane treatment. None of the prisoners in U.S. custody would be protected by the laws of war. In a far corner of the U.S. military base at Bagram in Afghanistan, a former Soviet machine shop had been converted into a prison. There, Mozambique would be interrogated by American agents using tactics that had been refined in the prison camps of Stalin's Soviet Union.
The hands would be placed right above the head and tied or shackled to the top of the door, which was the entrance to the cage. I saw people who literally were no longer able to physically sustain that position and they just hung off limp. The entire weight of their bodies being held by their wrists.
That goes back to the Middle Ages. It was called strapado by the Spanish Inquisition.
Clive Stafford Smith has represented more than 40 prisoners in U.S. custody during the War on Terror, including Mozambique.
And it basically dislocates your shoulders slowly and very painfully.
After one interrogation, Begg was dragged into a cell and hogtied, his hands cuffed behind his back and chained to his ankles, and left that way overnight.
I would be interrogated any given time of the day or night, unannounced. Interrogators would walk in and tell me to get up. The guards would make sure that I'm seated or standing, depending on how long I'd been in either position.
A floodlight was aimed into his cell 24 hours a day.
You want to fall asleep. You want to do anything in order that you can just lie down in the corner, no matter how hard the floor is, how cold it is, no matter how uncomfortable sleep would be with shackles on your arms and legs.
Depriving a prisoner of sleep also has a name from the Middle Ages. Tormentum insomniae.
It goes beyond being scared now. It just, you know, you just want to sleep. They produced pictures of my wife, my children, and waved these pictures in front of me, asking me if I knew what had happened to my wife and kids that night, if I thought they were safe, if I thought I'd ever see them again, if I really cared about them so much that I would tell them everything.
A woman began to scream in the nearby cell. Threats against a prisoner's family were called second-degree torture during the Spanish Inquisition and were commonly used by the Soviet KGB. For 2 days and two nights, he heard the woman he thought might be his wife being tortured.
If there's any point in my life that I wanted to kill somebody, it was this point. And if I could have got those shackles around their necks, I would have done so and got out to the next room just to stop what's happening.
During the 11 months Mozambique was imprisoned in Bagram, at least two men in U.S. custody there died. In Guantanamo, he was locked into a 6-by-8-foot cage where he would spend the next 2 years in isolation. His nightmares were filled with the screams of a woman.
The 1994 U.S. torture statute defines torture as an act committed by a person specifically intended to inflict severe physical or mental pain or suffering upon another person within his custody or physical control.
In March 2002, U.S. intelligence teams, backed by more than 100 police officers, had moved in on a suspected al-Qaeda safe house in Faisalabad, Pakistan.
He said, "Allah Akbar," three times. "I am ready to be a martyr. Kill me."
Abu Zubaydah, alleged to be a major figure in al-Qaeda, was severely wounded but taken alive.
Hauled in a guy named Abu Zubaydah. He's one of the top operatives plotting and planning death and destruction on the United States. He's not plotting and planning anymore. He's where he belongs.
The man FBI officials called al-Qaeda's travel agent, and so a minor figure, had disappeared into the spider web of secret CIA prisons spread across the globe.
Martin Lederman, Georgetown University Law.
When the White House and the Vice President's office were in 2002 urging the CIA to engage in a detention and interrogation program, something they apparently had not ever done before, and to use techniques that appeared on their face to violate several different legal restrictions. The CIA quite understandably said, "We're not going to do that unless we are given some assurance by lawyers within the Justice Department that this is lawful."
The agency insisted on what one official called a golden shield. On August 1st, 2002, they got it. In an opinion requested by the White House and delivered by John Yoo's office in the Justice Department, the vice president's lawyer had framed the core premise.
Congress can no more interfere with the president's conduct of the interrogation of enemy combatants than it can dictate strategic or tactical decisions on the battlefield.
That is, any attempt by Congress to interfere with a presidential order, even if it crossed the line into torture, would be unconstitutional. And any interrogation would be legal, unless it caused pain that was
equivalent in intensity to the pain accompanying serious physical injury, such as organ failure, impairment of bodily function, or even death.
If you define torture as organ damage, death, or almost death, then you can stand up and say that you don't do torture. And I think that's what they were doing.
In secret White House meetings chaired by National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, a committee of top officials that included Vice President Cheney, Defense Secretary Rumsfeld, and CIA Director George Tenet reviewed and approved the specifics of harsh interrogations. Many of the proposed techniques were based on the military's secret SEER training, survival, evasion, resistance, and escape, for Americans at risk of capture by torture regimes.
The simulated captivity is supposed to expose students to it's a stock phrase that every instructor memorizes, a totalitarian evil nation with a complete disregard for human rights and the Geneva Convention.
Malcolm Nance is a 20-year veteran of the military intelligence community.
And if you can endure a totalitarian evil nation with a complete disregard for human rights and the Geneva Convention, you can pretty much endure everything.
Richard Armitage.
My particular class was ambushed. We heard a lot of shooting outside the truck. Some strange fellows with accents and strange uniforms with stars on their caps pulled us out of the back of the truck, started slapping us around, and the next thing I knew, we were in a prison camp.
Like Richard Armitage, SEER trainees are slapped, hooded, their sleep disrupted. Under the constant watch of physicians and psychologists, they are stripped, exposed to temperature extremes, sexually humiliated. And some officers at the Navy's SEER school were subjected to what has been known since the Spanish Inquisition as the water torture. During World War II and Vietnam, it was prosecuted by the U.S. as a war crime.
I was put on an incline, where my legs were like that and my back went down. A wet towel was put over my nose and mouth, and it was completely soaked, but I could still breathe. And then a question would be asked, and I would not answer, and water would slowly be poured in this, and the next time I took a breath, I'd be drawing in water.
You start to panic, and as you panic, you start gasping, and as you gasp, your gag reflex is overridden by water, and then you start to choke, and then you start to drown more, because the water doesn't stop until the interrogator wants to ask you a question. And then for that second, the water will continue, and you'll get a second to puke and spit up everything that you have, and then you'll have an opportunity to determine whether you're willing to continue with the process.
I did realize that the people doing this were actually on my side, but the sensation to me was one of total helplessness, and I have had a lot of sensations in my life, but helplessness was not generally one of them. But the sensation was enormously unpleasant and frightening.
In 2002, at a secret jail in Thailand, contractors, whose expertise was in the Army's SEER torture resistance training, not interrogation, led the CIA's mental demolition of Abu Zubaydah. He was confined in a cage called a dog box, so small he could not stand. The Red Hot Chili Peppers were blasted at full volume for hours on end.
Colonel Stephen Kleinman, Senior Intelligence Officer, Air Force, 1985 to 2008.
If our purpose was, as interrogators, to do what the KGB was doing much of during those show trials, and that is to force somebody to comply and create propaganda, then they're great. They'd be perfect. But that's not what we're after. We're after intelligence information, which is true.
Abu Zubaydah was stripped naked, held in frigid cells, doused with cold water. Video cameras recorded him 24 hours a day.
Did the CIA not understand the difference between SEER resistance training and interrogation for intelligence purposes? And if they didn't, I find that shocking.
The agency was on tenuous legal ground as well, and so insisted on high-level authorization for each new step, including one of the harshest SEER techniques, waterboarding. It was the newly coined term for the centuries-old water torture.
There's no simulation here. It's controlled drowning. Water is entering your system. It can overload your ability to gag it out.
There is no question in my mind, there's no question in any reasonable human being, there shouldn't be, that this is torture. I'm ashamed that we're even having this discussion.
Though the administration would later admit that Abu Zubaydah was one of three prisoners who were waterboarded, hundreds of hours of videotape of his interrogation had been destroyed. And that meant any evidence of the water torture, a felony under U.S. law, had been destroyed as well.
You're listening to a radio adaptation of Torturing Democracy by Sherry Jones of the National Security Archive. We'll continue with the second half in just a moment. We just heard one of the military intelligence experts express his surprise at the use of these torture techniques to elicit intelligence when these techniques have been known since the Inquisition to serve the purpose of eliciting false confessions for show trials. However, if 9/11 is an inside job masterminded by elements within the administration to create a justification for a so-called war on terror, that is actually a project to use the military to seize important natural resources and strategic positions around the globe for American capitalists, then the false confessions of alleged terrorists that can be shown to the American people are just what is needed to keep up popular support for the effort. The neocon ideology advocates the importance of having an external enemy that will unite the populace behind the ruler, as was covered extensively in the documentary The Power of Nightmares by Adam Curtis, aired on this show in the past. The CIA is quite familiar with torture, as is the U.S. military. The School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia, which is now known as WINSEC, is engaged in teaching torture techniques to military officers of Latin American client dictators. Survivors of the covert wars in Central and South America during the Reagan-Bush administration in the 1980s, of which Rumsfeld and Cheney were a part, reported the presence of Americans directing their torture sessions. As we heard in John Pilger's documentary, War on Democracy, that aired on this program, as was explained therein, part of the purpose of torture is as a deterrent to rebellion among the population to be subjugated. The people doing the actual torturing don't need to be in on the strategy. They just need to be whipped up to hate and fear their victims, often with the help of racism. From American lynchings to Nazi death camps, we have many examples of how state propaganda can recast harmless people as a mortal threat in order to deflect anger away from the ruling class. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN, Nashville, WUOW, Oneonta, KRBS, Oroville, WKNH, Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton, Bealeton, KSOW, Cottage Grove, or WMRW, Warren. We continue with the conclusion of Torturing Democracy by Sherry Jones.
On August 4th, 2001, a 26-year-old Saudi named Mohammed Al-Qahtani flew from London to Orlando, Florida, with $2,800 in his pocket, but no return ticket. A suspicious immigration officer refused him entry.
Mohammed Qahtani had been detained at a U.S. border station in Florida.
Colonel Britt Mallow headed a special Pentagon task force of the military's criminal investigators.
When he was first captured, information was developed that indicated that he was, in fact, the same person that had been turned away at the border.
And that meant Al-Qahtani might be the 20th hijacker, recruited for the team that would overpower passengers on United 93. As the first anniversary of the 9/11 attacks approached, demands from Washington for actionable intelligence from al-Qahtani, in custody at Guantanamo, escalated. In September, the Pentagon announced that Major General Jeffrey Miller, a career Army artillery officer, would run both the detention and intelligence operations at the prison camp. "When I showed up at Guantanamo," he later acknowledged, "I had never before witnessed an interrogation."
If you look at some of the people that were put in charge of Guantanamo, they had very little experience with intelligence. They had very little experience with detention operations. They had very little experience with interrogations. And yet these were the ones that were making the decisions and were put under the pressure to make those decisions without a lot of good information.
On September 25th, that pressure intensified when lawyers from the War Council, David Addington and the Pentagon's Jim Haines, arrived from Washington along with the CIA's top lawyer, all of them well aware of al-Qahtani. The secret August torture memo, providing legal cover for harsh interrogations, was figuratively at least in their pockets. In addition to its narrow definition of illegal physical torture, the memo also argued that
for purely mental pain or suffering to amount to torture, it must result in significant psychological harm of significant duration, lasting for months or even years.
A week after the lawyer's visit, a senior CIA official instructed Guantanamo officers on various SEER-derived tactics. According to minutes of the briefing, he told them, "Complying with laws against torture is basically subject to perception. If the detainee dies, you're doing it wrong." 9 days later, the outgoing commander of Guantanamo's interrogation corps, who would later testify that his marching orders came from the President of the United States, officially requested authority to use harsh methods,
such as those used in U.S. military interrogation resistance training or by other U.S. government agencies.
He listed some of the same SEER tactics the CIA had turned into a blueprint for torture, including
the use of a wet towel and dripping water to induce the misperception of suffocation, and scenarios designed to convince the detainee that death or severely painful consequences are imminent for him and or his family.
On December 2, 2002, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld signed off on an action memo prepared by his general counsel, Jim Haines, approving 15 of the proposed interrogation techniques. Many of them defied the military's own definitions of cruel and inhumane treatment. Al-Qahtani could be kept in isolation, stripped nude, kept awake and interrogated for 20 hours at a time. Phobias, such as fear of dogs, could be exploited, as could painful stress positions, keeping him standing for up to 4 hours. The secretary, who works at a stand-up desk, added a handwritten note. "I stand for 8 to 10 hours a day. Why is standing limited to 4 hours?"
It just showed an incredible naivete, or, and I think this is probably more the case, an incredible hubris. No one sat down, not John Yoo, not David Addington, not Dick Cheney, not Donald Rumsfeld, and said, "What's the cumulative effect of allowing all these things to be done? What if you were to do 12 of these things repeatedly over a 45-day period in the dark, with no exposure to the light, no sleep, hypothermic temperature conditions, hanging by your wrist from the wall sometimes? That's not torture? I don't think anyone ever sat down and thought about that. If they did, they condoned it.
The Uniform Code of Military Justice prohibits U.S. Armed Forces from engaging in cruelty, oppression, or maltreatment of prisoners, assaulting prisoners, or communicating a threat to wrongfully injure a detainee.
Mohammed Al-Qahtani, detainee number 063, had already been in solitary confinement for months. According to FBI agents who saw him,
he was evidencing behavior consistent with extreme psychological trauma, talking to non-existent people, reporting hearing voices.
Now his interrogations would intensify. An hourly log leaked from Guantanamo narrates the harsh details. He is forced to wear a woman's bra. A thong is draped over his head, sexually taunting and humiliating a Muslim man. A leash is tied around his neck.
11:15 hours. Began teaching the detainee lessons such as stay, come, and bark to elevate his social status up to that of a dog. Detainee became very agitated. 1300 hours. Dog tricks continued, and detainee stated he should be treated like a man.
9 hours later, while women are in the interrogation booth, he is stripped naked.
2200 hours. After approximately 5 minutes of nudity, the detainee ceased to resist. He stated that he did not like the females viewing his naked body.
80% of these military interrogators were very young. They were 18, 19, 20, kids who were kids who essentially were serving their country.
Mike Gellies feared what he called force drift at the offshore prison, that abusive tactics approved for Al-Qahtani's interrogation would spread.
Here we had all these alleged terrorists in Guantanamo Bay, and we weren't getting the intelligence that leadership thought we should be getting. So it was time now to begin to think about how are we going to expedite this process. Ticking time bomb. All of this shapes the context.
My top agent strongly believed that we could not be a part in any way to anything that might be seen as illegal or improper. I sent out by email instructions to our agents, if you see something that you think is wrong, we want you to report it to us immediately. But we want you to disengage.
While Colonel Mallow was ordering his investigators to stand down, General Jeffrey Miller, just 5 weeks after taking charge, put forward a standard operating procedure for his interrogators based on SEER. This order has never before been shown in its entirety.
These tactics and techniques are used at SEER School to break SEER detainees. The same tactics and techniques can be used to break real detainees during interrogation.
General Miller, he wasn't an expert in detention operations, in intelligence operations, and especially not in interrogation. So he relied on the experts that he surrounded himself with.
They were mostly from the CIA's equivalent in the Pentagon, the Defense Intelligence Agency, or DIA.
And they were telling him these aggressive ways of getting at it were the best. We offered an alternative, and General Miller basically said, if you're not going to help us in this, if you're not going to participate in this, if you don't want to be on our team, you're out of here.